The session is titled Lessons from the Obama Administration. And perhaps I could start by taking you right back to the beginning of your involvement with the Obama campaign. How did you first come to know of the kind of the details of the candidacy and the campaign and then come to be working on the campaign prior to the election?
Sure, absolutely. And before I answer the question, I want to thank the Vice Chancellor and everyone here at Griffith University for having me. It is such a pleasure to be here and to be in Brisbane. So thank you so much for that. The campaign and how that got started. I think in the world of Washington, people often say it's very difficult to get that first job in Washington because it's not like any other place. You don't go to an employment agency and put in your resume or CV and all of a sudden come away with a job. And I start there because the way that I ended up working with the campaign actually is rooted in the work that I did working in the United States Senate. And I was there for a little over 8 years working for Senator Edward Kennedy. And in the course of doing that, I had the opportunity to work with the Democratic leader's office, Tom Daschle, and his chief of staff, a man named Pete Rouse. Pete ultimately went on to become then Senator Obama's chief of staff, and then later he was counselor to the president and one of his senior advisors. But Pete called me one day and said, hey, what about joining the campaign or thinking about this? You know, the senator is thinking about running for president. And I'll be honest and say that I had always said there were two things I would never do. I was never going to work on a campaign, and I was never going to work in a White House. So, yeah.
Can I just ask why you'd felt that, particularly about the White House? I mean, I'm sure for most of us, working in the White House would be right at the top of a list of career aspirations. Why did you feel that at
exactly,
that point?
Exactly, and why I'm such an awesome career planner. I had worked, as I said, for Senator Kennedy, and I loved working for him. I mean, unlike many other senators, in fact, I would say the vast majority of senators, certainly recent decades. He was a master legislator. He got things done, and he worked on a national stage, even as he represented his constituents in Massachusetts. It was hard work, but I loved it, and I loved working for someone whose ideals I shared with regard to helping the most vulnerable and civil rights issues and education policy, et cetera. So after that experience, one, as a policy matter, I felt like I had had such an amazing and interesting career there working for someone for whom I had so much respect. It's like, what could be a greater honor than that? One, and two, in my head, working on a campaign always involved like sleeping on the floor. And it just is like, I'm just not, that's not where
sure.
I am in
I
my
get
career.
That. I get that.
But after talking to Pete, and quite frankly, initially saying, this isn't the thing for me, after we got through the primary season, which is the season we're in again right now in the United States, and they were heading into the general election, so we knew it was going to be Obama versus Senator McCain, Pete called me again and said, let's have this conversation again. And we did, and I was compelled. It was such an amazing moment in American history with Barack Obama being becoming the Democratic nominee. I appreciated his vision, and one of the things I deeply appreciated about it is that it was really grounded in empowerment of everyday people to be engaged and to change their communities, their states, and the country. And that's something that animated me, and that's what led me to join the campaign.
You talked about a very exciting time in American history, and Ian alluded to that in his introduction. I want to talk about that second half of 2008. Because the campaign is going to the country with this very uplifting message around change and around possibility, an ultimately successful message. You get to November and you win the presidential election. But of course, at the same time, the economic and financial world is kind of crumbling under all of our feet. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you're kind of parallel tracking at this point. You're thinking, well, you know, we're going to the country with these very empowering messages, but if we win this, and when we win this, we are going to have a very different set of challenges than we might have forecast even 6 months ago. Upon entering the White House, how did the administration kind of adjust to that, the need to kind of quickly reset and recalibrate around a very different set of external circumstances than you would have forecast even months before?
Sure. Well, the one thing I will say is during the campaign, I'll say it this way, as we got deeper into the summer of 08, we realized the significant level of economic distress that the country was in. And it wasn't until we were in the transition, and you know, I think we always speculate about what happens to a prime minister or a president once they take office. Do they take them in some back room and tell them all those secrets that no one else knew about? And in some ways, that is exactly what happens. Yeah. You start to get data and access to information that, in our case, told us just how bad the economic situation was. So while we were driving a message of hope and change, and some of that was really about the people's ability to drive hope and change in the country, mm-hmm. to be the change that you want to see in the country, and that's consistent no matter what, the dire circumstances were becoming more and more apparent the closer we got to the election. And certainly once the election was over, we had a strong sense of that. So going into the White House on January 20th, 2009, we went in at that point armed with a plan for how we would proceed because the circumstances dictated that. I mean, we really were hanging on by our fingernails. I mean, in terms of the state of credit and access to credit, the number of jobs we were losing. I still have to go back and check those numbers because I still, to this day, find it hard to wrap my mind around the number of jobs that we were losing and the fact that we lost almost 9 million jobs in a very short period of time. And so we were forced, in many ways, to both set up government and at the same time meet the need, or else the country, we felt, was going to fall into, and you know, as part of a global economy, fall into even worse circumstances. So we mapped out a legislative strategy that would allow us to meet those concerns and those needs. And simultaneously, as my former colleague, our chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, now mayor of Chicago, Illinois, would say, don't let a good crisis go to waste. So how could we use that moment of dire need, the fact that we knew we were going to have significant resources that we had to pump into the economy to also to try and drive some of the change and some of the reform that we also felt critical for the nation?
So upon entering office in January 2009, I want to ask you about your own personal responsibilities. You have responsibility over a very wide set of domestic policy areas. You're looking at education, health, climate change, energy, transport, communities. I mean, it's an enormous sweep of the policy spectrum. Mm-hmm. How do you, A, develop a clear sense of priorities around how you mm-hmm. attack each of these areas, and B, draw them together in a coherent whole so that you have a kind of a story or a policy program that you're putting to the electorate?
Sure. Well, we got really wonderful advice. I mean, that period, this 87, 89 day period that we are in, what is technically known as the transition, after the election, before the inauguration. And we spent a lot of time, my colleagues and I, talking to those who had held our positions previously, including those in George W. Bush's administration. I can say they were fantastic to us during that transition period. And to understand how they organized themselves and how they addressed the big problems of the day. Because when you think about it, the White House Small is really tiny. And I think it's one of the things that first grabs people when they walk into the White House, that physically it's a small building and the staff is very tiny. And then you've got all the departments and agencies that are doing their work, and it is our responsibility to coordinate their work and make sure it aligns with the president's vision and his priorities. So one, it is a matter of understanding from the president what those priorities are. Two, working in a collaborative nature with the secretaries and the rest of the sub-cabinet staff to make sure that while they are churning through the day-to-day, that we have a very clear eye on what the top priorities are of the president. And as someone told me during that transition period, put on a bulletin board in your office what the things are that you want to accomplish. Because every single day you're going to be hit with wave after wave of things that you never expected that would happen or people could do or think. And at the same time, you have to address those things, but you cannot lose sight of what your priorities are, what the president's priorities are, and the way that you're going to execute against them. And that happens in a process with the president. It was my responsibility to feed back to him what the cabinet secretaries were thinking, also to go out into the world and to hear what's going on the ground, and also to understand what he had articulated as a matter of priority during the campaign and help to form that into a coherent agenda. And at the same time, we were doing that and executing against that, moving legislation through the Senate and the House of Representatives. We had to have a narrative that in turn we shared with the American public about what we were doing and why, which in the legislation is hard, the narrative is just as hard.
There's a little bit of a theme emerging in a couple of things you've said. You kind of quoted Rahm Emanuel's mantra of don't waste a good crisis. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that you need to have a kind of a list almost physically up on a notice board to kind of remind you of the agenda. I mean, politics is famously about events and responding to the unexpected. How much of a kind of ideal policy program can remain intact? And how much of it is about grasping challenges, turning them into opportunities? Mm-hmm. How responsive can an administration be?
You have to do both at the same time. And it is a matter of understanding priorities. So, for example, we knew going in that healthcare reform was a priority. It was something the president campaigned on. It was something he was committed to do and felt as though he had a mandate. He had political capital because of the election that could help him drive it through. We had as decent a majority as we could possibly have in the House of Representatives and the Senate to be able to move that through. And simultaneously, we had this big economic crisis that mm-hmm. you just talked about. And we had to push forward on that. And we felt as though healthcare reform was directly tied to that. That because of the amount of gross domestic product that it was gobbling up, that we had to be able to get healthcare costs or start to bring healthcare costs under control, in addition to the morality of the issue, people who didn't have healthcare coverage. So that required us to think about ways that we could try and tether those things together, meeting the need of the crisis and being responsive to that, but at the same time, keeping our eye on the priority, a priority that the president had articulated during the campaign that we felt was literally a once-in-a-generation opportunity, because we saw decade after decade after decade of people trying and failing to get health reform through in the United States, comprehensive health care reform through.
I guess there's another factor at play here too, isn't there, in that the expectations of the American public of the incoming president were stratospheric at the time of his election. And so I suspect you have a set of expectations that in any realistic sense can never be fulfilled by any individual or any administration. And how conscious of that are you as you're assembling the policy program, and how do you try to manage those expectations in a reasonable way to kind of map out what is possible and achievable versus perhaps the kind of exuberant mm-hmm. hope that the American public had invested in this president?
Right. And I don't think that you can really realistically manage that. There was a lot of pent-up desire and demand and aspiration and hope and a desire for change that was built into that election. I think the president articulated that so beautifully on the campaign trail. And then you have mixed with that the fact that there had been 8 years, and as you know, both sides would call it, after having been out of power, kind of 8 years in the wilderness. And here we were, you know, control of the House, control of the Senate, control of the White House. People believed that a lot could happen. There was a lot of demand coming from advocacy groups across the spectrum, and everybody had their program, their initiative, their legislation that they wanted to see move forward. And I often reflect back on a period, one day in particular, in probably December of 2008, when I was going to speak to a large group. There were several colleagues of mine and I that were going to speak, and hearing the excitement and the enthusiasm and the crowd and the cheering, and people were so excited. So many hopes were pinned on this election that were historic in so many ways. And I remember thinking, literally, these people are going to hate us one day soon. And it was painful to reflect on that at that moment, and it was certainly painful to live through the reality of those moments as we move through the administration. Because it was our responsibility to keep an eye on the complete landscape and how one thing affected another in ways that to the person outside of the building you wouldn't expect. And quite frankly, for advocates, that isn't their role. And we all have our roles to play. Theirs to drive and to press and to push and to demand certain kinds of change, and ours to figure out what we could do and how we could do that, working with the House and the Senate in a system of checks and balances. And we had, and it would be an understatement, a very loyal opposition that had made it quite clear that they did not want to work with us. So it was impossible to fulfill all of the aspirations that were pinned on us. And at the same time, and I would say this personally, you always think, how could I have explained it better or articulated in a more clear way? We couldn't get it this time, but this is something we're deeply committed to and we'll come back later. And I remember the president, and I think it was the change in the ban on the military, don't ask, don't tell, the ban on gays and lesbians being in the military. And the president, after we managed to pass that piece of legislation, I remember him looking at advocates who had said, your strategy isn't going to work, you're not going to get it done, you don't really care about this. And he looked at them with that look that the president can get in his eye, and he said, I told you I was going to get this done. Sometimes you have to come back around to it, but people don't always believe that you can or that you will or that you want to.
Perhaps a related question, just in the context of thinking about expectations. I think it's fair to say that here in Australia, probably like in America, we're absolutely obsessed by opinion polls and polling. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested, I mean, government's fortune is kind of, any move in opinion polls is just absolutely descended upon by the 24/7 media commentariat, picked apart. No doubt the same for you. How do you separate the kind of influence of polls from policy development process? I'm sure you need to be conscious of it, but how do you kind of keep the two things distinct in the kind of machinery and operation of mm-hmm. policy development?
Sure. And you're right. You have to lead, and at the same time, you have to be responsive. One of my former colleagues, probably heard of, David Axelrod, or as we called him, Axe. And Axe had the responsibility of really digesting all of that information once we were inside the White House. And we would start our morning meetings, and often, you know, he'd kind of give us the top lines. But the other thing he would also say is, and, you know, Mrs. Smith's second grade class had a poll, and they said X, and Mr. Jones's fifth grade class. In other words, his point was, there are lots of polls every day, to your point, with lots and lots of information. And if you move daily based on those polls, you will whipsaw yourself.
Yeah.
There were certain things that we realized we had to focus on. We had to get a sense of where the trends were going. But at the same time, again, going back to that list that was on the bulletin board, what are the things that we are trying to accomplish as we move forward, and how do you stay true to that?
Can I go back to something that you mentioned earlier on in your remarks, and it's about the kind of role and power of community.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama famously was a community organizer in Chicago prior to entering the Chicago legislature, and it seems to me that that's something of a recurring motif in the work of the administration. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us how you tried to kind of harness the untapped assets of communities, the leadership within the communities, particularly in trying to rebuild after the recession. How did that kind of permeate the administration's policy?
Sure. We did that in a number of different ways, and you're right. That's something that the president feels quite passionate about. I think after the White House years are over for him, you will see that continue, and the things that he focuses on are of importance to him. And there are a lot of different ways that we did it, some more successful than others. I mean, coming out of the campaign, so there was Obama for America, which was one of the organizing mechanisms for the campaign, and OFA became Organizing for America, with the idea that we could try and harness some of that, the power of all of those millions and millions of people who had been supportive of the president during the campaign as we went through the process of legislating, both on the federal level, but also the state and local level. And I think, you know, over time, that process has strengthened, but it was something new, something that really hadn't been done before, and that was hard. So not executed in the way that I think anyone involved would have originally imagined or wanted from the beginning. But at the same time, there were other ways, for example, in the Domestic Policy Council that I ran, and also in the other policy councils, that we tried to execute on that. There was quite a bit of attention focused on, in fact, one of the first bills that we passed was called for my former boss, the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act, which focused on community service and focused on national service, both for young people all the way through seniors, so that they could become more engaged, that we would have an apparatus that was strengthened and strong that would support their engagement in any number of different endeavors, whether it be education or energy. There were core members and others who went to the Gulf Coast after the BP oil spill, you know, on and on. So that was one way that we did it. We also focused on building out a council that focused on, community solutions. The president often said the best solutions are not found in Washington, D.C. So we put together a council with the idea that we would look at what was happening across the nation and those communities that were most successful in finding ways to meet the big challenges that they were facing, that they had identified in those communities, and what was special. Were there particular themes, a way of acting that could identify why those communities were so successful? And in fact, I remember we started this work in the spring of 2009, and I got married, my husband is here with me this evening, in June of 2009, and while we were on our honeymoon, apparently the president gave some speech and said, and I'm sending Melody out to communities all over the nation. Oh, okay.
Honeymoon.
Right. But we brought together a council of people who work and who were experts across all sectors, the private sector, the philanthropic sector, community-based organizations, local government, state government, because we felt they could bring their expertise to this concept and to this idea. They studied it. They did find that there was a particular strategy, a way of acting, that's now been identified and given the name collective impact as a way of going about solving big social challenges. And we started to act on that in terms of recommendations that were given to the government for action, and then continuing this work post outside of the White House. It's my work that I do at the Aspen Institute now to continue to drive that change and, to engage communities across sectors in identifying these big challenges and solving them. And the final thing that I'll just mention is the Social Innovation Fund. Again, social entrepreneurs, people who had built really smart organizations that evidence had proved were successful in taking on some of these challenges. How do you take those things to scale so that they not only are working in one city or two communities, but so that you're taking them to scale across the country?
I want to ask you a little bit about education and employment, and particularly, I mean, in some of the communities you're talking about, one of the huge challenges that the administration faced in your time in the White House was this mass rise in unemployment in the wake of the recession. How were you able to, perhaps at a community level, work on employment pathways and link those things into education such that you could start to see job generation, job growth rebound?
Well, several different ways. One, you know, I mentioned the stimulus bill that we passed at the beginning of the administration, and we had identified education and workforce development as being critical. But we also recognized that we needed to innovate around some of those ideas. So we used some of those resources to create an innovation fund that worked with, or that granted resources to local, so district school systems, which is kind of the smallest or the most local form of government for school districts, who are also working with the private sector, who are working with community-based organizations to identify the best ways to take on some of the education reform challenges that we saw. And then taking those ideas, putting them into a larger learning community so people around the country could learn what was happening in those in local districts and take those ideas back. It was a way of trying to take those ideas to scale. So, you know, innovation fund. Also, I mentioned this work of the council a couple of minutes ago and the work I'm doing at the Aspen Institute. And we are focused in particular on, and the council focused as a particular challenge, on the challenge of young people and young adults, 16 to 24 years old, who for whatever reason have been disconnected from the education pathway and then to employment. So it may be that they had dropped out of school. It may have been that they had received what we in the United States call a GED, so not a high school diploma, but had taken a test that showed that they had a level of competency that gave them a GED, but had not gone on to post-secondary education, which we recognize is critical to so much of employment and well-paying employment, not just in the States, but elsewhere in the world. So we focused on ways that we could build out these pathways in communities around the country on the local level to reconnect these young people to the education system, make sure that they completed secondary, went on to get some kind of post-secondary credential, whether it's a certificate or through an apprenticeship of some sort, or a two-year associate's degree, and on to a good-paying kind of middle-class job. So that work also started in the administration. And the administration continues to think about ways to take on these challenges based on things that we started. We moved a big higher education bill. When I was there, it was part of the healthcare bill, healthcare reform bill, actually, that put a lot of resources into higher education, in particular into our community college system, which is a two-year education system after a person completes their secondary degree. And it really it serves as a gateway for many into either a good middle-class wage job or an opportunity for people to get new forms of training that they might need to retool given the new economy. So we put immense resources there, and that work continues to this day.
I mean, I guess that particular challenge in the United States, like everywhere else in the world, is evolving rapidly with digital disruption, mm-hmm. with the kind of globalization and the threat to traditional middle-class jobs. Melody, on a personal level, what policy achievement are you most proud of? If you look back at this period in your life and in mm-hmm. American life, what do you look back on most fondly or with most pride?
Yeah, I mean, it really is like picking from among your children. I mean,
pick a few. Just walk us through. Introduce us to the family.
You're right. There are a number of things. I started out in Washington working on civil rights and constitutional rights work. You know, greater opportunities for women, for minorities, for the gay and lesbian community and on. And I have seen the evolution of the policy. Some of it I started working on with Senator Kennedy that President Obama ultimately was able to sign because we were able to move it through the legislative process or to overturn and reform areas that took many, many, many years. So I'm certainly proud of that. I think because I started work in the civil rights community, my view of education has become that it is the great civil rights issue, that it provides opportunity in a way that very few things do. And I think about my own experience. You know, I look back at my grandmother's, and my mother's mother was a domestic worker. She worked in a tobacco factory in the southwest part of Virginia, the state where I grew up, and worked extremely hard to help put my mother through college. And to do that at a time when not that many African-American women were able to go to college. Mm-hmm. And through that and scholarship my mother was able to do that and go on and get her graduate degree. My father's mother was a cook, and my dad went into the Army after he finished high school, married my mother, and then went back to college. I remember him going to college when I was a little girl. I remember we'd go to the library together. I think that's one of the reasons I love our library so much, and I'd get all my books, and he'd have his books, and we'd study together. And in my home, education was seen as a remarkable opportunity and a gift, and there was also an assumption that if I would go to college, and if I wanted to go to professional school and I went to law school, that I would be able to do that and my parents would support me. And I look at that arc from my grandmother's to my parents to me. And in that arc, we have tobacco worker, domestic cook, to a person who is able to sit in the Oval Office and advise the president. And as a result, I believe that if we can give children and young people and adults access to education opportunity and good education and excellent education, then we are giving people tools to be able to create greater social mobility for themselves and for their families. So the work that I was able to do working for Senator Kennedy and working in the White House is something that I'm extremely, extremely proud of for that reason.
It's a wonderful personal story, Melody. It's a wonderful American story. Perhaps the last question before we throw it over to the audience. Can I ask you to gaze into the crystal ball for me? And I'm not going to ask about the obvious thing. I'll leave that to them because I know it's coming.
Whatever do you mean?
How do you think history might judge Barack Obama and the Obama administration?
I think history will judge this president quite well. And I'm very proud to have been part of his administration. Again, healthcare reform, as messy and complicated and difficult and the challenges, and some of them self-inflicted, as it has been, it was an enormous victory, an enormous step forward for the United States. And I know much of the rest of the world where there is comprehensive health care and universal health care kind of looks at us and goes, where have you people been? But for us and our system, it is an enormous accomplishment. I think also being able to move the nation forward, even in this point of grave economic crisis, also very, very important. And even though, another thing I will say, some of the civil rights victories, particularly this transformation in our country with regard to civil rights for the gay and lesbian community, has happened in such a dramatic way. And much of that has happened because of the push that came from the outside. Mm. I mean, if you remember where the president started,
yeah.
I mean, it was a big push from the outside, and I think it created the space for him to be able to move forward. So that's something that I think he will be remembered quite favorably for. And there is much left to be done, painfully much left to be done when it comes to issues of immigration. But, you know, what he's been able to do for some young people who are undocumented immigrants in the United States is important. And his willingness to speak passionately to those issues at a time, and I'm sure it'll come up in the questions later in our political system, at a time when there's so much resistance to these issues is important. And then obviously, I think literally who he is and the way that he has served this country as the first African-American to be elected. And he and the First Lady have carried that tremendous responsibility and privilege, I think, with a great deal of grace. And that is important to the country being able to move forward as well. And I could list others, but those are some of the things that I think will help shape the way people think about this presidency.
And of course, you know, 11 months of important work to go, not least the nomination of a Supreme Court justice.
Right.
So how about we turn it over to you guys? I understand there's a microphone moving around. And we have a question right here in the front center, sir. Can you just wait perhaps till the microphone arrives so everyone can hear what you have to say?
With regard to civil rights, one of the important things that's happening right now is the voter suppression. What is and can be done about what is happening in some states to prevent particularly African Americans from voting?
Voter suppression. Yes, this is a significant issue in the United States. It's actually an issue that I started working on when I first started working in the House of Representatives. And there are laws being passed in many states that make it far more difficult for individuals to vote. And those laws, in many ways, are targeted, though it isn't expressly articulated, are targeted at African Americans and Latinos to prevent them from voting. There are a number of both advocacy organizations, outside advocacy litigation organizations, as well as the Department of Justice that have been working on and taking on these issues and moving through our federal courts, district and courts of appeal to try and push back and to overturn these laws, in some cases successfully and in other cases unsuccessfully. It is one of the great tragedies and challenges, particularly when you have people who wrap themselves in the flag and patriotism who are clearly trying to prevent others from being able to vote. I mean, at the same time, there are positives as various states, because so much of election law in the United States is effectuated at the state level, that are trying to move forward with policies that make it easier, whether it's a same-day registration, whether it's voting by mail, different ways to try and make it easier for people as opposed to, you know, leave your job on a Tuesday, stand in a long line, and try and vote. Which in and of itself, I think, is a form of suppression.
Talk about barriers to participation, huh?
Yeah.
Yes, question up there on the right, my right-hand side.
Thank you. I'd like to return, if I may, to the issue of stratospheric expectations.
And I'm sorry, could you speak up just a little bit?
Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Excellent. If I can return to stratospheric expectations, you spoke about that juxtaposition of a message of hope during the campaign with the dawning knowledge of what was happening and what was on its way. And you also touched on how that's played out since with disappointment. I wonder if you had your time again during that campaign, with the benefit of hindsight, what advice would you give or what would you do differently?
That's a great question. I don't think that you can campaign with a kind of hope, kind of change message. For better or for worse, with my fellow country people, we like a big, bold message. And I think every candidate needs a reason to run, to be, say, I want to be your president. What is the big goal? What is the big ideal? At the same time, and this is where the challenge, and I think I respond to your question this way, at the same time, every administration needs a way to execute against that ideal in very specific, concrete ways, knowing you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, and you're going to disappoint just by nature of the way the government works. And you've got to be able to take the country along with you as you're having that experience. So this is the goal, the ideal. These are the ways that we want to try and address that specifically through legislation or executive action and other ways. And this is how we are, how we're trying to get there. And here's why we need your help in trying to do that. There will inevitably be the losses that you suffer that people will be furious about. But at the same time, I think the clear articulation of that and helping and bringing people with you at least brings along some buy-in and some sense of why what has happened has happened. You know, an example, and it is different. I mean, it's one thing to be president, it's another thing to be United States Senator. But one of the things that I often saw when I worked with Senator Kennedy is that while there are many senators who kind of gave the stiff arm to kind of the outside community, they didn't, you know, it was like, it's difficult, it's messy, you know, they're always asking me for things. Senator Kennedy really wrapped his arms around the outside, we call them the outside groups, the advocacy community, and embraced them and saw his partnership with them as just that, a partnership. And as a result, they also saw his deep commitment to those issues. And there were times when he would have to go back and say, I can't get that. And this is the deal I have to cut. And it is not what you want at all. And they would be furious with him. But sitting underneath all that was a knowledge that they were partners, that he wanted the change, he wanted to achieve something, and he just couldn't get it. And I think it is like being in a constant conversation with the American public about how we're moving forward and what is achievable and what is not. And then you just have to accept the fact that sometimes, as I heard the president say to people, if I could wave a magic wand, I would, but I can't. That isn't the way our system of government works, and people just don't want to hear that.
Yes, up the back in the middle, perhaps.
It's wonderful listening to you. Congratulations on the achievements, delivery. My question is, you would have gained a lot of wisdom through this experience. What advice you would give to the future leaders to make the world, the people happier, wealthier, harmonious?
So what advice would I give future leaders?
Absolutely. If it is, I'm sure you will have tons, but the top three or whatever. Thank you.
My top three or list of advice. I think one of the first things, and this may sound completely unrelated to a political conversation, but I think in anything that you do, the first thing that's most important is a strong sense of self-awareness and sense of self. What is it that you want to get up to do? What is it that you want to commit yourself to every day? What is it that you care passionately about and the challenge that you want to take on in no matter in any sector? And what skills and talents do you have to bring to that challenge, and what are the things that you also need to develop to be able to do that? And I think that's important because I've seen lots of people in a lot of different sectors, some successful, some not, and I think those who are most successful often have that sense of themselves and what it is that they get up for and that they're committed to. I would also say that often people believe that the big challenges of the world get taken on in a particular sector, that you have to go into government, that you have to go into public service or, you know, work at an advocacy organization or a think tank, which are things that I have done and I've loved that. But I believe, and this is consistent with what I mentioned earlier with that sense of collective impact, that complicated challenges don't get solved by a single actor or a single sector. So taking all that you learn in a place like this, your deep commitment and your passion for those issues, and determine where are the best places for me to be able to deliver on that. Because you can do spectacular work to move things forward from the private sector or from the academy, or from government at every level of government. And you can also do that, and this is so much of what today's opportunities offer, you can spend part of your life doing that in one sector and another part of your life doing that another. So in other words, don't limit yourself inside the lines or to a very narrow way of thinking about how you can go about affecting change. And then I would also say that it's so important, and we were talking about this a little bit before we came in the room, to learn how to and take every opportunity to learn how to work across difference, and to work with people and to observe what's happening in other parts of the world, and understand cultural differences, and what is smart and innovative that's coming from different parts of the world. I think it's something you often hear American or certain group of American legislators, and they only want, you know, what is America doing? And I love my country, but it's a big world, and there are lots of innovative, smart things that are happening around the world. So being able to grasp onto that and to bring it into your country or your community and to understand how to work across and navigate the differences of the people who are sitting around the table with you, but who may share a common vision with you, or maybe not. But learning how to move forward, I think those are incredible skills to be able to gain to affect change in the way that you describe.
Okay, we probably have time for one last question, and I'm going to go right in the middle there, please.
Thank you, Melody, for such an interesting discussion. I'm just wondering whether how you feel the mood of the nation is in with regard to gun control, and whether you feel that it's sort of moving in a particular direction. And sorry to do the crystal ball gazing, but yeah.
Sure. The American relationship to guns and the Second Amendment is, to say an extremely disturbing one would be an understatement. I'm sure you have heard the president speak to these issues with great frustration and anger and sadness. I mean, particularly if you look back, you know, you can look back on any number of different incidents, and they take place every day in communities every day. I mean, you hear about the big ones, and kind of the mass shootings, but every day we see what's happening as a result of our gun laws or the lack of enforcement or regulation with our gun laws. It is a case study in American political power with the National Rifle Association, the NRA, and its lock on members of the legislature. I think some of that is about commercial interests. It is often articulated as Second Amendment set of interests and protecting people's right to bear arms, which is an unusual interpretation of the Second Amendment and the way that it has been interpreted thus far. But right now, it is there's a grip on legislatures, both at the state level and at the national level, that has us paralyzed and unable to move forward. And I will be honest and say to you that I am not sure what is going to break that grip. Anytime you can turn on your television and learn that 5-year-olds were killed in their schoolroom, and then understand from friends of mine who worked on the Hill and who worked with those families as they were on Capitol Hill and looking into the eyes of legislators and saying, please do something about this. This is a common sense proposal. And the needle doesn't move, then you know that we have a significant challenge and problem ahead.
Melody, that's a very heavy and somber note to finish on. I might just remark in raising the tone to a somewhat lighter subject that we got through, I think, 50 minutes of American political discussion without mentioning the T word.
I know.
which I find remarkable.
He would be stunned to know that.
Maybe we should let him know that at a university campus in Brisbane, Australia tonight, we
this is a safe place.
Politics.
Thank you.
Melody, look, I found that fascinating. I have no doubt everyone else in the room has found it equally fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing that.